Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. And welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your new host, Callie Fell. Today, I have the privilege of sitting down with Wendy Kramer, a co-founder and director of the Donor Sibling Registry, or DSR. Wendy and her donor-conceived son, Ryan, founded the Donor Sibling Registry to assist individuals conceived as a result of sperm, egg, or embryo donation who are seeking to make mutually desired contact with others with whom they share genetic ties. With 72,000 members in 105 countries, the DSR has helped connect more than 20,000 members with their half-siblings and or their biological parents. Without any outside support, Wendy, Ryan, and the DSR have pioneered an international discussion about the donor conception industry. Wendy has co-authored 26 papers on donor conception in journals like Social Science and Medicine, Fertility and Sterility, the Journal of Law and Biosciences, as well as many, many more. Wendy has reviewed abstracts for the American Society of Reproductive Medicine and has been a peer reviewer for the journals Human Reproduction and RBM Online. Wendy has also authored 3 books, one of which is a children's book titled Your Family, a Donor Kid's Story. Not only is Wendy an impressive author, but she was an associate producer on the 2011 Emmy-nominated documentary titled Sperm Donor, and was on the 2013 MTV News and Docs 6-part docuseries called Generation Cryo. Wendy and her son Ryan have appeared on 60 Minutes, Oprah, Good Morning America, The Today Show, CNN, NPR, and CBS Sunday Morning. The Donor Sibling Registry has been highlighted in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Harvard Law Review, and hundreds of other news shows and publications around the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Venus Rising, Wendy.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I have so much that I want to talk with you about, but first and foremost, I think a congratulations are in order. I understand that you recently hit a huge milestone with the Donor Sibling Registry with over 20,000 members matched to biological family. Let's start with that. Tell me more about that. Tell me more about the Donor Sibling Registry and this huge milestone.
Yeah, so actually last week we hit a big milestone, which was 72,000 members. And we were kind of riding on that milestone about, wow, that's huge impact in the world, 72,000 people. And then just this past Friday, we hit another milestone of those 72,000 people, we've now matched 20,000 of them. So that means 20,000 people have either connected with their half siblings or their biological parents or biological children. And so the 20,000 number is significant in that not only those people's lives have been impacted, but also the families of those people, you know? So it always makes me, these milestones are important to me because usually, you know, my head is down, I'm doing my work, we're doing what, you know, all the things we do on the DSR, you know, the main thing is connecting people, but it's not until we hit these milestones that I kind of lift my head up and go, oh, wait a minute, that's huge. Like what we're doing actually has huge impact. And so, yeah, it just makes me feel really good to hit that milestone and to know that we're, you know, busier than ever and connecting people and helping to educate them and support them. And, you know, we just keep plugging along.
Yeah. And it's nice to know like these milestones, right? That you're making an impact, right? It's all this hard work is paying off.
Yeah. I mean, so much of my day to day is like, you know, working on the website or doing the things that are not the fun parts, you know, for me, the fun parts are actually talking to the families and, you know, relating to people. And so a milestone like this, it's all about relatedness and people finding each other and connecting and lives being enriched and families being expanded. So to me, that kind of a milestone it's the most important milestone because it's about how we affect people and their families.
So first of all, congratulations. That's awesome. And I, you know, through your writings and through your publications and through Jennifer, you know, Jennifer, I've been very, very impressed by your work. And it seems that this has been mostly inspired by you and your son's story. So do you mind kind of, let's back up a little bit and telling us a little bit of your personal story and how the donor sibling registry was inspired and then how it works?
I was married in 1989, and my husband at the time had infertility issues. So we went the route of an unknown sperm donor, and my son Ryan was born in 1990. And I only stayed married for about a year after that. And from then on, I pretty much raised Ryan as an only parent. My ex-husband and I, you know, separated, they got divorced. So from a very young age, Ryan actually was only two when he came home from preschool, and he had been seeing moms and dads picking up their kids at preschool. And he asked me, so did my dad die or what? And I thought, oh boy, I didn't think we were going to have this conversation now, but okay. And so we had a two-year-old conversation about, you know, to have a baby, you have to have the egg from a mommy and a sperm from a daddy. And I didn't have the sperm from a daddy. So I went to a nice doctor. You know, it was basically a 30-second conversation appropriate for a two-year-old.
Wow, that's hard.
Well, but it was so quick and easy. And I thought, okay, this is great though, because now I've laid the cornerstone conversation to build upon, you know, for the rest of his life. We're going to build upon, this was a very important conversation. And then as he grew up, he was very curious and inquiring kind of a child. And by the time he was about six, he was looking at me saying, I want to know who my biological father is. You know, I want to know what makes me who I am. And it was at that point that I really started questioning, like, wow, what have I done? And what do I do? And nobody told me about this part, you know, that my child would, of course, be curious about his genetic origins and why he is the way he is. You know, I think we're all this wonderful and unique blend of nature and nurture, but you can't deny or negate or minimize the nature part, the DNA part. You know, my son was 50% of my DNA, but he was also 50% of this unknown person's DNA. And then, you know, ancestry and medical background. So I stood by his side, you know, kind of walking him through this curiosity. And I sort of empowered him by having him write a letter to the sperm bank, you know, expressing his frustrations. But nobody really would help us, not my local clinic, not the sperm bank. And so we had to pretty much wait for social media to be invented. And around 2000, finally, it was invented. And it was first in the form of Yahoo groups. So we, in September of 2000, we started a Yahoo group thinking, okay, I have a curious kid. I wonder, is he the only curious donor-conceived person? You know, maybe, but we don't know. So we started the Yahoo group. It grew kind of slowly. And it wasn't until about, I think it was the end of 2002, we started getting some media. Sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. Like I said, these things happen. Makes us more human.
So anyway, let's see. So in 2002, we started getting some media attention. And it was the first time, I think, for donor-conceived people and their families to really begin to consider that they had the right to be curious, the right to search for, and the right to connect with their previously unknown genetic family. So it was from that point on, really from 2002, when we started matching people. We started connecting half brothers and sisters and donors with their biological children and donor conceived adults, you know, with half brothers and sisters. So, you know, it was, we were off and running. It was one of those things like build it and they will come, you know, and it was an idea whose time had come. We kind of took the ball and ran with it and started connecting people. And then it was out of these connections, we began to realize, oh, wow, this industry isn't the way that we thought it was. Everything that the sperm banks and the egg clinics had told us wasn't necessarily the truth. And there were some things that could be better and that should be fixed. So that kind of became our mission too. So we became, our mission at first was just connecting people, and then it grew to include connecting, educating, and supporting all those in the donor family. So all stakeholders, egg donors, sperm donors, parents, and donor-conceived people.
Wow, that's really incredible to have a space for all of those people. How does one, say we have a listener who's listening who might have been a donor or who just found out that their donor conceived, how does your website work? Do they go on and create a login? How does that process kind of work, or what does it look like?
So for the majority of people who have the luxury of knowing the clinic or sperm bank that was used and their donor number, is very easy. You just come to the DSR, you join, you add a posting under the clinic or facility and with the donor number. And if other people are already posted under that facility with that particular donor number, bingo, you're a match. You can share photos, medical information, messages. You can remain private. Some people, you know, not everybody comes at this with the same speed. Some people jump in and want to meet the next day for coffee. And some people are like, you know, just a little bit more cautious and maybe let's get to know each other, you know, through messages first. But so for most people, it's as easy as that. You can search the registry before you add a posting. You can see if anyone's already posted for your particular donor number. And for people, you know, we're in 105 countries, so not all the countries have a donor numbering system. And donor numbering really came into being when cryobanks started in the late 70s, early 80s. So we have a lot of donor conceived people born in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s without a donor number, but they can connect too. You know, they can add their posting under their doctor, you know, university clinic, you know, wherever their parents went. And if they find others that the timing is right. So, you know, they do have two really important pieces of information. They know the place and they know the dates. So sometimes people connect and say, you know, my mother used a doctor on Park Avenue in New York City, the summer of 1967. All I know about my donor is he was a medical student with blue eyes, you know, and then somebody else might say, hey, my mom used that doctor, you know, in September of 1967, and it sounds like we have things in common. Then they can share photos, you know, ultimately, of course, they'd want to get DNA testing to either confirm or deny relatedness. But, you know, we help everybody connect, those that have a lot of information and even those that have minimal information.
Wow. I can imagine the emotion that someone might go through during this process. So, you kind of mentioned that, you know, donor conceived people are starting to get older, right? This is kind of a newer technology, but now people who were conceived through anonymous donation are becoming adults. And since you've been in this process for the last 20 years, what are some, in your experience, what are the biggest problems or issues that these donor conceived people are experiencing?
Oh boy, there's a lot of problems. This is a very broken system. The reproductive medicine industry for decades has been all about the rights of a facility or a clinic to sell the gametes, and the rights of a parent to have a child, and the rights of a donor to be anonymous. But nowhere in that conversation, especially when it comes to setting policy, nowhere in the conversation has there ever been consideration of the needs or the rights of the donor-conceived people, the very people that everybody's working so hard to create? So, you know, that's a good kind of, it's a good place to start, is to say, okay, as we go forward and we look at policy and we look at the way this industry runs, let's first and foremost have the donor-conceived people in mind, because we didn't know some of these things 20 years ago or 50 years ago, but we do know them now. We've done a ton of research. You know, we've been doing what we're doing for 20 years, two decades. So we're pretty clear on, you know, on how things could be and how they need to be. So I think that the people setting policies and making rules, given that there's like just about no regulation and no oversight, it really comes down to the egg clinics and the sperm banks. They, you know, what we would like to see is for them to really consider the needs and the rights of the people that they're helping to create, the donor conceived people, you know, and part of that would be, for example, have accurate records. Keep records on how many kids and who they are born for any one single donor. I mean, it's unbelievable to think that those records don't exist or, you know, they're incomplete. So the sperm banks in particular, they don't know how many kids are born for any one donor. They don't know who the families are. And then that leads into the next problem of updating and sharing medical information. You know, if there's some crucial medical information, how can you possibly share it with families so that kids can get preventative care or adequate screenings or diagnostics when you don't even know the kids to reach out to because you have no idea which kids are born for, you know, for that particular donor? So, you know, we see it in the numbers of donor kids born for any one donor, especially with sperm banks. We now have many, many groups that are not only over 50 or 100, but now even over 200, which is mind-boggling, just mind-boggling. So
that's incredible to know you have 200 half-siblings or...
Well, you know, and they just keep selling the sperm, you know, it's just unbelievable. So those are two main things I would say are, you know, let's start with accurate records. Let's know how many kids are born for any one donor and who they are. Let's have a record of that so that if there is updated medical information that we can readily share it with the, you know, with the families, with the children. And sharing of medical information goes both ways. You know, what if there's a child that has, you know, a fatal heart condition. Well, we need to be able to go back to that donor who might be having children of their own to say, hey, there's a genetic, you know, heart condition here that you need to go take your kid in, you know, for screening or testing for. So I think the accurate record keeping, and especially as it relates to the numbers of kids born for any one donor, tracking who they are, and also the medical issues. Those are, I'd say those are like the top tier things that we'd like to be, that we'd like to see change. You know, like really, it's hard to believe, but they don't change anything. They don't, because there's no regulation and no oversight, they just keep doing what they're doing.
Do you think that talking about the medical conditions and mental health conditions of donors, so sometimes, right, these donors, well, I think most of the time these donors are young, right? Young college age individuals. And maybe they haven't seen the manifestations of a medical condition or mental health condition. And so do you think that donors are honest and complete in their own evaluation that they're giving to the clinics? And then it seems that you kind of answered my second question. Do children have access to these conditions later? And it seems like no. And are there any places that are doing this well? Are there any places that are keeping track of these medical records well, or is it just not being done?
No. I mean, in our research, we found that most sperm donors and egg donors were not followed up for health histories. And the problem is, you know, what you get from a donor is a snapshot of one day in the life of a healthy 20-year-old or 25-year-old, you know? And so many diseases are adult onset. So while the donor might have been very healthy as a 19 or 20-year-old or 22-year-old, we don't know what happened the next year or 2 years later. You know, did their father die of a heart attack? Did they get breast cancer? Did they get diagnosed with schizophrenia, you know, or other mental health diseases? So the problem is you get a very incomplete medical history. It's all self-reported. A lot of donors don't know what their grandparents died from. It's just a very incomplete medical history because you don't know how accurate it is going back. And also going forward, there is no going forward because, you know, many of the donors, I think it was like 98% of the egg donors that we surveyed were never contacted to update their medical records. Yet 31% of them said that they or close family members did indeed have a medical issue that would be of importance for families to know about. So, you know, it's a really, this is a crucial thing. And we see it on the DSR all the time. You know, one of the main reasons that people connect on our website, it's medical. People want to share and update medical information, if not with the donor, certainly with the other families. And it's been, you know, in certain situations, it's been life-saving.
As a nurse, I can see so many implications with that. Just, you know, not, you know, I've heard people say, you know, DNA doesn't matter. It's not what makes a family.
Well, sure it is. Sure it is. You know, here's the thing. So when people say that DNA doesn't matter, it's like, well, DNA isn't the only way to make a family, but of course it matters. Of course it's a way to make a family. If it didn't, we'd all give birth in the hospital. And then when it came time to go home, we would go into the baby room and just pick a baby, any baby, you know?
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
Yes, we want the baby that we're genetically related to. So it matters. And that's where the disconnect is. So for so many parents, it's like the genetic connection with your child matters on one side, but then you negate or ignore or dismiss that genetic connection on the other side. You know what I mean? So it's like this big disconnect. You're saying that a genetic connection matters sometimes, but not other times, you know? And what we're saying is that in most cases, it does matter. You know, it again, it's that wonderful blend of nature and nurture, but you can't say nature doesn't matter. You can't say nurture doesn't matter. Like, they both matter almost equally, you know, and they should be looked at with just as much weight to both sides.
So you mentioned your own research as well as other research. And I feel like research is starting to become more available, although limited. What have you seen as far as new research that's been done on donor conception and how it affects children who turn into adults? What is research showing us, either medically or emotionally or in any aspect about donor-conceived children that, you know, eventually turn into donor-conceived adults?
Right. Well, I mean, what we've seen reflected in the research is, of course, what we, the donor families, have known all along. Like, there's really no big surprises at this point. The reason that we've continued to churn out the research is because for so long, like, the American Society of Reproduction would sort of dismiss us and say, oh, well, we don't take anything that they say seriously. It's all anecdotal. Show us the research. Okay. So now for, you know, what, 13 years, we've been pumping out the research, you know, in peer-reviewed academic journals. And it, like, rarely do they even acknowledge it, you know, because the things that we're saying, if you were to take them seriously, you would actually have to consider making changes to this industry. And of course, none of them do. You know, the ASRM, they are the sperm banks, they are the egg clinics, it's the fox watching the hen house. So of course, they don't want to read or acknowledge our research, because if they did, they would really have to take a good look at the way things are run and make some changes, you know, evolve. But we see very little of that happening. I mean, one case in point is, you know, just something like disclosure, you know, a child's right to know the truth about the way they were conceived. We've known now for, you know, decades, us, the families, have known, of course, disclosure is important, and early disclosure, pre-verbal, is important. But even the ASRM, up until very recently, has, you know, kind of insisted, well, that's a personal choice and that's a family choice. And they really didn't even take a stand on something like disclosure, you know, and we're just all like scratching our heads going, seriously, like, you can't even take a stand on disclosure? You and your mental health professionals have not read the research and the experiences of adopted people to understand how important it is to have a family based, you know, if you're going to make a happy and healthy family, you have to base it on truth. You cannot lie to your child about something like this. So, you know, even with disclosure, they're just rounding that corner to say early disclosure is best. So the industry is so far behind. what we in the families have known, what then we took to research and also showed through research, but the reproductive medicine industry is just so slow to get there because, you know, again, because it would, if they acknowledge the research and what we've all learned about donor conceived people and secrets and the way the industry is run, it would demand that things evolved and changed within the industry, and they just don't want to do that.
Do you think that they don't want to do that because of the money issue? Like, why do you think that they're so slow to change and to take the well-being of these young adults and adults into consideration?
Yeah, whenever you look at this industry and say, why don't they do this? Or why are they still doing this? Or why not this? Whenever you ask any of those questions, the answer is always the same, and you hit the nail on the head: money. It's always money, because it costs money to have accurate records. It would cost money to limit the number of kids for any one donor. It would cost money to keep accurate medical records. It would cost money to reach out to families who used a donor when a medical condition was reported. It would cost money to really have a more ethical and responsible reproductive medicine industry.
Yeah, it's a shame that money seems to be the bottom line over how we treat one another. I read on your website that one of your goals for 2021 is to continue to encourage oversight and regulation of the fertility industry. So what does that look like for you? And are you hopeful that the fertility industry will improve?
Oh, I wish I could say yes. You know, I hate when I sound like a Debbie Downer about it, you know?
You know, I tell my husband all the time that being realistic is not negative.
Oh my gosh, I tell my son that all the time. I am not a pessimist, I am a realist.
Amen.
I take all the information in, and that's how I decide. You know, I don't come at it with a negative viewpoint, but you know, I'm in the trenches every day. So I'm talking to donors, I'm talking to parents, I'm talking to donor conceived people who turned to me after trying to get information from their clinics and their sperm banks, you know? So I'm in the trenches. I hear about the realities every day. I'm also in the trenches, well, not since COVID, but we're presenting research around the world. So I'm at the, you know, ASRM meetings, the ESHRE meetings, the, you know, reproductive medicine conferences around the world over and over and over several times a year. I'm talking to the sperm banks and the egg clinics and the reproductive endocrinologists and the mental health professionals. So I am talking to them nonstop. And what I hear back, it just seems to be the same old story. You know, this is the way we've always done it. This is what the way we do it. You know, some sperm banks are like, we've always had anonymous donors, and this is the way we're going to continue on, even though there is no such thing as donor anonymity anymore. But it's like, they just, if they were to acknowledge that fact, they would have to change so many things. So better to keep their heads in the sand, just keep selling every vial of sperm as anonymous, even though that's not even possible anymore. Not properly counseling and educating parents and donors at the front door, you know, because the decisions that they're making on that day will affect a donor-conceived child for decades, you know, but it's like they're just not properly counseling the parents and the donors about what they're doing, you know, the decisions that they're making in that moment of time. And you can see that, you know, you just go to their websites and it's marketing materials. You know, it's all about making family and, you know, all about a parent's right to have a baby. And, you know, and that's important. I mean, you know, I wouldn't have a kid without my sperm bank. You know what I mean? But, and I'm not saying they shouldn't make money. Like, sure, you know, I'm all for them making money, but you can make money and do it in an ethical and responsible manner. So, you know, that's all that I'm saying to them is, yeah, I'm not saying, you know, end the sperm banks, or I'm not anti-sperm bank. What I'm saying is, if you're going to operate an industry that creates human beings, there is a level of integrity and responsibility and ethics that you need to meet, and you haven't been meeting it.
I guess I struggle with how it can be even ethical, even if we are transparent about the donors. And because I guess I still keep thinking about the kids. And do studies show that there are any type of problems or issues that arise even with kids who do know that they are donor conceived? Or, you know, and I guess that's where I have a hard time even, is because we are, this is another, you know, this is another life, and maybe we're not always entitled to be parents and to, you know, so that's where I struggle with that.
No, I totally get that. And that needs to be included in the conversation. So one way that we see the system can work, and we've been doing this with egg clinics now for more than a decade. We've got more than 24 egg clinics and agencies that write the DSR right into their contracts so that parents and donors are connecting right from pregnancy and birth. So this way, a child from right from the beginning has access to all of her parents, to the parents who are raising her, be them biological or not, and to the other parents, the biological parents, who, you know, without them, they wouldn't have life and they wouldn't be who they are. So now we don't have kids who are old enough to see how they've fared and what the differences are, you know, with having access to your biological mother from day one. But I suspect there's going to be quite a difference.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. And that's something you're going to be looking at, right?
Eventually, yeah. We just have to wait for, you know, wait for time to go on. But I know, I mean, just personally, if my son wasn't cut off from his biological family for his entire childhood, it would have been very different for him. You know, like, for example, when he was starting to play piano when he was 6 years old, and he said, "I wonder if my donor plays piano." We could have just hopped on the DSR or sent an email, or depending on what level of, you know, correspondence we had with the donor, called him up or sent him an email or whatever and said, "Hey, Ryan's just starting to play piano. Have you ever played a musical instrument?" You know, so it just having access, you know, it's not like for most kids, like when my son first met his biological father, or, you know, when they first started corresponding, before they even met, the deepest, most penetrating questions for my 15-year-old were, "What's your favorite music? Do you go mountain bike riding? Were you good at math?" You know, like, they're not deep penetrating questions. They're just, "Give me a hint of why I have the interests I do, or the talents I do, or, you know, just why I am. Why do I look the way I am? Do you have like big eyebrows like me?" You know, like things like that.
Right.
So it's even like,
it's part of our belonging, right? And at that age, we want to belong. We want to know who we are.
Well, and part of knowing who you are is knowing where you come from. You can't fully know who you are unless you know where you come from. And that I know in my bones, I know that from my own son, from my research, from my 20 years at the DSR, and from talking to thousands of donor conceived people, you know, and the curiosity can be mild. Some people are mildly curious, just like adoptees, but some people are just driven. They say, "I cannot be a whole human being until I know where I come from." And so I think as parents and donors, those are the kind of kids we have to plan for, because we could get them, you know, the ones who are just driven to know, desperate to know. And then us as parents need to consider, okay, if I'm going to have one of those kids who is desperate to know where they come from, how will I handle that? You know, how will I explain to them that I used an anonymous donor, that I brought them into the world with no chance of ever connecting with one half of their ancestry, their biological relatives, their medical background? You know, and that's what I tell parents who are kind of jumping into this world, dealing with, you know, either infertility, or they're a single mom, they haven't met a guy yet, they know they're meant to be a mom, or LGBT families, is like, okay, before you make any choices, start reckoning with the child that you haven't yet created. And here are some of the things they might one day ask you. So you better, like right now, as you're making these decisions, be prepared to have that child look at you like my 6-year-old looked at me and said, "I want to know who my biological father is." oh my gosh, like prepare yourself for that. You know, what will you say?
Yeah, we've had a couple, actually, I think three donor conceived people on our podcast, and each one of them talked about what you're describing. They wanted to know why I'm so engineer focused. Nobody else in my family is this way, you know, and why am I this way? And it turns out that, you know, their genetic material that they were tied to through the donor, that's where they were getting that, you know, and they all had this curiosity just that you're describing. So I find that very fascinating.
Well, my son, he became an aerospace engineer at age 18, and he had his master's in engineering at age 19, and then went to work for NASA at age 19. And his biological, and I am not like that, but his biological father has the same master's degree that my son has. You know, like that's no coincidence.
That's great, yeah.
Well, he got the engineering gene from him, you know, I don't think like that. But that's, as my son was growing up, you know, having this kind of unusual academic path, that was one of the main things for him, was like, where did I get this brain? Why do I think the way that I think? And, you know, in these ways, it's very different from my mom or her side of the family. Why am I like this? You know, and it wasn't until he met his biological father and all of these, you know, relatives on that side of the family, that all the little puzzle pieces started clicking into place, that, you know, he could understand why he is who he is. And then we've also seen this for his half siblings. You know, as all of these half siblings meet, you can almost hear all these little puzzle pieces clicking into place for all of them as questions are answered, or, you know, things like struggling with anxiety or depression, you know, things like that, where they felt like maybe they were deficient in some way. And to understand that that's a genetic thing, that you've got X amount of your half brothers and sisters that also struggle with these types of things, I think it just normalizes everything and gives these kids a greater understanding of, you know, not just like their achievements and their talents and their physical attributes, but also their struggles, you know, like, oh, here, you know, I've kind of beat myself up for so long about, you know, struggling with depression or something. And it's like, it's genetic, you know, and here, now I can connect with my half siblings or my biological parent. We can share with each other about what's worked and what hasn't worked, because a lot of our brains, you know, are probably wired very similarly. We might respond to certain medications the same, you know, even something like that can be crucial in these connections.
I have one more question kind of centered around like donor anonymity before I want to talk to you about your books and other things like that. But do you think that, since the fertility industry is still kind of marketing as anonymous, even though I think you wrote once DNA equals donors, not anonymous. And I really like that. But do you think that if the industry gets away from advertising it as such and are honest about that, do you think that there will be fewer donors? Do you think that donors will take on that responsibility of knowing, hey, someone might contact me someday because I would be their genetic mother or father? How do you think that would shift the donors?
Yeah, well, I think that if donors were properly counseled and educated at the front door, including the number of kids, anonymity, everything, I think one of the consequences of that would be that there probably would be less donors. But I think that's just what's going to happen. In order to have a more ethically and responsibly run industry, one of the repercussions is going to be you just might have fewer donors. But I think that, you know, there's always a cost and a payoff. So the payoff is to have a more ethical and responsible industry, but the cost might be there might be fewer donors. You know, I think if we, you know, look at organ donation, it's ethical and responsible. Like you can't sell your own heart. You know, there's ethics in organ donation. But if we took away those ethics and said anybody can sell any body part or organ, you know, probably more people's lives would be saved. So the fact that that industry is run more ethically and responsibly, it might be costing lives. You know, not everybody that wants a heart will be able to get a heart. But is that a reason to take away the ethics, you know, from organ donation? No. So it's kind of the same thing. Like the cost might be to run a more ethically and responsibly run reproductive medicine industry. it might be there might be less donors, you know, and that kind of seems like a no-brainer to me. But that's what the reproductive medicine industry kind of hooks into, that fear. And that's kind of their talking point. It's really the only talking point they have, is reproductive choice. And, you know, if there are regulations, you, the parent, won't be able to have the child you so desperately desire. And they market this to, you know, the infertile couples and the LGBT community. They kind of say, like, you know, the whole reason we're fighting regulation is so that you, the parent, can have reproductive rights. And to me, that's BS. You know, like, I'm happy to have a reproductive rights conversation about the right to have a child, but that's not what having a more ethical and responsible sperm donation and egg donation industry is. Those are two separate conversations. You know, you can have ethics and responsibility and consider the rights of everybody.
Well, thank you for that. You have co-authored a few books, and I'm really excited to hear more about the kids' book, but would you mind telling us, and for our listeners, we'll include a link to each of her books in the introduction on the website, so you can find those there. But tell us about your book. So one of them, I'll just read the title, Donor Family Matters, My Story of Raising a Profoundly Gifted Donor-Conceived Child, Redefining Family and Building the Donor Sibling Registry. That sounds like a very personal book and story. And then you have another book, Finding Our Families, a book for donor-conceived people and their families, and then a children's book titled Your Family, a Donor Kids Story. So tell us about those books, would you?
Yeah, so I guess we can start with the kids book. There are a few kids books for children who are born, you know, from egg and sperm donation, but every single one of those books that I saw, it was always, I got to the end of the book and the last page is, and then you were born. And I was like, but this isn't the end of the story. This is the beginning of the story. And what about half siblings? And what about honoring a child's right to be curious about and search for and connect with their half siblings and even their biological parents, the donors? So I wanted to put out a book that would be for all family types, because I didn't want to write three different books for three different family type. So it's one book that it's for a child born into any type of a family, egg donor, sperm donor, embryo donation, LGBT, single moms, infertile couples. And it addresses not only how you came to be, you know, in like the sperm and the egg, and it's very child friendly, and you can read the book, close the book, and then go into your own personal story. So it's really like a tool for parents to use. And then as the book goes on, we also, for the first time in any of these kids' books, we talk about half siblings. You might have two or three. You might have a lot more than that. We kind of introduce these concepts, and we hope that parents will then in turn introduce the same concepts to kids at a very young age. They need to understand that other people might have used their donor. There might be 10 or 20 or even more than 100 kids that share half their DNA with your child. And then I think also for parents, kind of getting over that barrier, that fear and shame about acknowledging there's another human being on the planet who gave 50% of the DNA for your child. So I think it's really important for the parents to kind of come to terms with this and then allow these conversations to happen in the household and to be welcomed, not to be feared. So the book, you know, it's for kids to kind of grow up knowing their story. But I think even more so, it's for parents about, you know, I hear from too many parents that say, I haven't told my kid because I don't know how, or I haven't told my kid they have 20 half siblings because I don't know how. So it very much was for the parents about how to initiate these conversations, how to normalize all this, and how to keep these conversations ongoing in the most healthy manner for everybody. So that's the kids' book. You know, again, it's for, I would have read it to my two-year-old. Maybe he wouldn't have understood everything, but I would have, you know, kids are never too young, I think, to start telling the story, because we know through anecdotal research and through, you know, published research, the donor-conceived kids that fare the best are the ones when we ask them, how old were you when you learned the truth? And they said, I've always known, you know, basically pre-verbal, or they don't remember. It was so long ago, they don't remember.
I see. Wow. That sounds like a great tool for parents to have, because I can imagine that can be a very could be a scary conversation to have, but that's great that you've provided that for people.
Well, and I think for some parents, they haven't really processed the grief of their own infertility, and they have to do that. They have to do that before they pass along that grief in the form of shame of donor conception. Like I hear from too many adult donor conceived people who are just finding out, you know, nowadays it's through DNA testing that the majority are finding out, and their parents are gobsmacked by it because they've carried with them through all of these years shame and embarrassment of infertility. And then they pass that along in the form of secrecy about donor conception, because secrecy implies shame. So what we're trying to encourage parents to do is, if you're dealing with infertility, it is your job to work through it before you pass it along to your child in the form of secrecy or being ashamed in some fashion of being donor conceived. So, you know, that's what this book was really put out there for parents, like kind of get your own stuff together before you pass it along to your kid.
Right, right. Very important. Tell us about your other two books. So these are geared for adults.
Yeah. So the Finding Our Family books book is for donor conceived people and their families, but it's really for donors, for prospective parents. It's kind of like the manual that I wish somebody would have given me when I was beginning this journey. It's everything that the sperm bank, the clinic, the doctor, the nurse, they're not going to tell you. So I think it's crucial for all parents to be, and also for parents raising donor conceived people, and for donor conceived people to help normalize all of it, to know I'm not the first one to walk this path. Many have walked this path before me. They've all survived. And it's not only advice from me, but it's advice from donors, from parents, from adult donor conceived people. So there's a wealth of information in there, I think, for all stakeholders. And then the book I put out exactly a year ago, Donor Family Matters, is more personal. It's my story. Kind of how my story informed my life's work at the Donor Sibling Registry. You know, I was a part of an infertile couple, and that led to having a donor child. And then that led me into really expanding my viewpoints on donor conception and what it all means and helping my child. And then, you know, that exploded into helping donor families around the world. And, but also my journey, I think, could be helpful to a lot of people in that it wasn't always smooth. You know, we hit the same bumps in the road with connecting with donor relatives that many other people face. You know, connecting with the donor wasn't always smooth sailing. It was tricky. We had to figure stuff out. You know, as you connect with your donor family, there's no rule book, you know, and we all have to figure it out and see what are we comfortable with. And not everybody proceeds at the same speed and with the same level of comfort. And some people are more skeptical by nature. Some people aren't. Some people's families are still deeply rooted in secrecy and shame. Some people's aren't. And I think it's kind of weird, but we have like a little bit of all of that in our family, but we've had to work through it all. And, you know, I think there's lessons that we learned that then I in turn could kind of put out there for other people to read about, to maybe normalize those things if they're going through them themselves.
Yeah. Well, and it's very brave and honorable for you to tell your story. I'm sure it wasn't easy, but it's been great that you've been able to turn your story into such a platform to help so many people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in many ways, I'm just another mom of a donor kid. You know what I mean? So when I'm on the DSR, when I'm talking to people, for the most part, I'm talking to them as a mom who I've come through it. I lived through it. I lived through having to make the choice to use a donor, having a kid who was really desperate to know his biological father, connecting with half-siblings, having half-sibling families with kids who still don't know, whose parents still haven't told them the truth. Like, we've kind of lived through all of it, and we've learned really valuable lessons along the way. It's really informed us so that we could help inform others, you know, and then also conduct the research and, you know, do all the other stuff. But we've just had an amazing opportunity through our own family to get our arms wrapped around so many of these scenarios.
We are getting close to running out of time. So I like to kind of always ask our guests this kind of question or question similar, but your book has lots of opportunities and suggestions and advice and that sort of thing. So what one piece of advice would you give parents who are considering to start their families using donor sperm or egg or already have?
Right. So we just put a brand new page up on the Donor Sibling Registry website just for prospective parents. So for any prospective parent, I would say go to that page. First and foremost, go to that page. It has everything and the links and everything you'd need to know what to think about as you were considering using an egg donor or a sperm donor. You know, it's everything that me and most of the other parents that we were never told. It's the stuff your sperm bank won't tell you, your egg clinic won't tell you. So many, many considerations. And then I would just tell, you know, for all the parents, the best thing you can do is educate yourself. Read, read, read. We have days of reading on the DSR website, and it's all there just, you know, for one purpose only, and that is to help educate everybody, you know. And then after you educate yourself, use us for support. You know, we have a Facebook group for chatting. I do phone consults. We have, you know, part of our mission is support. So we will be there to help you through the rough spots, through the tough decisions, through, you know, just dealing with all the donor family matters that happen. We've heard it all just about, I think. So we really want people to utilize us, you know, use us, use our organization and use our website.
Our time with Wendy has come to an end. And, you know, thank you so much, Wendy, for taking the time to meet with me and for all of the work you do for the donor community and donor families.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
It's been a privilege to have you on the show. And I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in. Our goal, as ever, is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you to think beyond the masses. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.